July 11th, 1996, Knoxville, Tennessee. The body of 31-year-old Blair Adams is discovered in a parking lot. He is nude from the waist down with $4,000 worth of different currencies scattered around his body, and the cause of his death is determined to be a violent blow to the stomach. Blair hails from British Columbia and had inexplicably quit his job to take a 4,000-mile cross-country trip to Knoxville. He had been exhibiting paranoid behavior and seemed convinced that someone was trying to kill him, but the exact circumstances of Blair's death remain unknown. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today's episode is a big one, as I will be covering a case that many of you have been anxiously awaiting for a long, long time. The mysterious 1996 death of Blair Adams. That voice you just heard narrate our opening was Christy Tarver, who won our most recent listener voiceover contest. Christy is one of the biggest supporters of The Trail Went Cold, and true crime podcasts in general, and I've even had the pleasure of meeting her at CrimeCon both last year and this year, so it was awesome to draw her name and hear her voice on the show. Thanks so much, Christy. Anyway, if you would like to enter this contest, I will be providing more details on how to do so near the end of this episode. Today's story is one of the most highly requested cases to cover on The Trail Went Cold, as it's the type of mystery this podcast was made for. Ever since it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries over 20 years ago, many true crime buffs have ranked this among the most baffling cold cases ever. I'm always fascinated by mysteries in which a victim is discovered at a location they had no reason to be at, but Blair Adams is on a whole other level. Since he made a 4,000-mile trip across North America from Surrey, British Columbia, Canada, to Knoxville, Tennessee, and nobody has any idea why. There's a lot to indicate that Blair was suffering from some sort of mental breakdown, but the incredibly bizarre fashion in which he was found dead makes one wonder what the real story is here. Since I was in Nashville for CrimeCon 2 weeks ago, I thought this would be the perfect time to finally cover one of the most infamous unsolved mysteries from the state of Tennessee. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is finally on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. And for as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards from our podcast, which may include stickers and thank you cards from yours truly, early access to episodes, and bonus content. I will be providing thank yous and shoutouts to our most recent patrons near the end of this episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now start examining the unsolved death of Blair Adams. Our story begins in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1996. Our central figure is 31-year-old Robert Dennis Blair Adams, who goes by the name Blair. At around 7 a.m. on July 11th, Blair's body was discovered in a parking lot off Interstate 40 for a hotel which was under construction at the time. But this was no ordinary death scene. Blair was nude from the waist down, as his pants and underwear had been completely removed. The pants were turned inside out, giving off the impression that they had been removed by force by someone else. Blair's shoes were off, his socks were removed and also turned inside out, and his shirt was open. In fact, it almost appeared that Blair had placed one of the shoes under his head like a pillow while he laid there dying. He had numerous cuts and abrasions on his face, which seemed to indicate he had been beaten by an attacker. There was a noticeable gash on his forehead, which may have been caused by a blunt object, and tufts of his hair had been ripped out. There were also cuts on Blair's hands, which may have been the result of an attempt to defend himself, and one of his hands was blackened. According to investigators, Blair also had injuries to indicate he had been sexually assaulted, but there was no DNA evidence left behind. In fact, the only DNA which could be linked to an outsider was from a long strand of hair found in Blair's hand. The hair did not belong to him, but it is yet to be matched to anyone. It would turn out that Blair had received a violent blow to the stomach which completely ruptured it, and the exact cause of death was septic shock. Strangely, it did not appear that robbery was the motive for the crime, as around $4,000 in American, Canadian, and German currency was scattered on the ground completely out in the open right next to Blair's body. In addition, Blair also happened to have a zipped-up fanny pack which contained $2,000 worth of gold, jewelry, and platinum. His driver's license, passport, and credit card were also left behind at the scene. Blair's duffel bag was found around the corner from his body, and it contained a number of receipts which provided investigators with a paper trail of how he traveled to Knoxville. And this brings the case to a whole new level of weirdness. It turned out that Blair actually lived over 4,000 miles away on the other side of the continent in Surrey, British Columbia, Canada, and the circumstances of how he wound up in Tennessee defied all logic. Blair worked as a construction foreman, and even though he had past issues with alcohol and drugs, which included a few scrapes with the law, he had been sober for 2 years and was attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. In fact, the autopsy report would show no trace of alcohol or drugs in Blair's body. Overall, Blair was a well-liked person who seemed to have turned his life around until he started displaying erratic, paranoid behavior and wild mood swings in the weeks prior to his death. According to his mother, Sandra Edwards, when she asked Blair if something was wrong, he simply replied, "I don't think I should tell you about it," without providing any further explanation. On July 5th, Blair decided to clear out his savings account and his safety deposit box at the bank. In total, he withdrew over $6,000 in cash, along with the gold, jewelry, and platinum which were later found in his fanny pack. 2 days later, Blair climbed into a Chevrolet Chevette in order to make the 3-hour drive from Surrey to Victoria in order to board a ferry which would take him across the Canada-United States border into Seattle. However, because Blair was carrying thousands of dollars worth of cash and valuables and appeared to be nervous, he aroused the suspicions of the border guards. When asked if he had a criminal record, Blair said no, even though he had been convicted on drug and assault charges in the past. Since he was now caught in a lie, the guards suspected that Blair might be a drug trafficker, so they refused to let him board the ferry and cross into the U.S. Blair returned home, and the following day, he showed up at his construction job and suddenly decided to quit. Even though Blair apparently asked his boss for his last paycheck, he did not actually take the check with him when he left. That afternoon, he then decided to spend over $1,600 to purchase a round-trip plane ticket to Frankfurt, Germany, a flight which was scheduled to leave from Vancouver International Airport the following day. However, hours later, Blair requested a refund on the ticket, claiming the person he was planning to visit in Frankfurt had gotten sick. It turned out that Blair did have a personal connection to Frankfurt. The previous year, Blair had traveled there to work on a job for his stepfather's construction company. During this time period, he became romantically involved with a German woman before he returned home to Canada. Even though Blair had claimed he was planning to visit someone in Frankfurt who had fallen ill, his German girlfriend said she did not know of any plans for Blair to come see her. Some of the people Blair worked with in Frankfurt said he was a confrontational person who liked to instigate fights, and apparently, Blair had expressed concern that some of these co-workers were returning to Canada and going to seek retribution against him. The same day he booked the flight, Blair suddenly showed up at a friend's house late at night. He told her that someone was trying to kill him and begged her to take him across the border into the U.S., figuring that he'd have a better chance of entering the country if someone else was driving the car. However, Blair's friend could not do what he requested. So on July 9th, Blair began what would become an incredibly bizarre cross-country odyssey. During the early morning hours, he was seen at the Pacific Highway border crossing, which is located about 25 kilometers south of Surrey. He made an attempt to cross the border on foot, but caught the attention of the guards because he appeared to have scratches on his hands and legs. He also matched the description of the suspect who was wanted for stealing a car in Vancouver, and the stolen vehicle was actually found near the border crossing. While the Border Patrol couldn't prove that Blair was responsible for the auto theft, they still denied him access to the U.S. Now, this part of the story is a bit confusing because the stolen car they found near the border was blue, and one friend apparently remembered seeing Blair drive a blue car the day before. Regardless, Blair later wound up at Vancouver International Airport, where he officially turned in his plane ticket to Frankfurt and rented a Nissan Altima. Blair drove his rental car back to Victoria to catch the ferry, and this time, he was able to successfully cross the border into the U.S. and travel to Seattle. Blair then drove to Seattle-Tacoma International Airport and bought a plane ticket to Washington, D.C. In yet another confusing decision, he decided to purchase a one-way ticket for around $770, even though purchasing a round-trip ticket would have saved him a bunch of money and cost half that amount. Blair hopped on the red-eye flight to Washington and arrived at Dulles International Airport during the early morning hours. It was here that he rented a Toyota Camry and apparently told the rental agent he was planning to be in the area for 2 days. But for whatever reason, he immediately left Washington and started driving southwest. Now, no one can be certain what Blair's actual destination was, but we do know that he drove around 500 miles and wound up getting stranded in Knoxville for reasons that once again defy all logic. The story goes that at around 5:30 p.m., Blair stopped at a gas station off Interstate 40 and soon told the attendant that he couldn't unlock his car. Gerald Sapp, a driver from Interstate Repair Service, was summoned to the scene, and Blair gave him his key. And it turned out there was a major reason it wouldn't unlock his vehicle. The key actually belonged to the Nissan Altima, which Blair had rented back when he drove from Vancouver to Seattle. For whatever reason, Blair claimed he no longer had the key to the Toyota Camry, he had just driven to the gas station. When Sapp asked him to check his pockets, Blair inexplicably refused to do so. Blair would need the rental car company to provide him with a key, but since they were now closed for the day, Blair would be forced to spend the night in Knoxville. The Camry was towed to a repair shop, and Gerald Sapp drove Blair to the nearby Fairfield Inn to drop him off. Sapp claimed that Blair was in such a hurry to exit his truck that he left his bag behind and Sapp had to bring it to him. And after Blair entered the Fairfield Inn, it took him a while to actually check in and get a room. The hotel surveillance footage would show that within the span of an hour, Blair entered and exited the lobby a total of 5 times before he finally went to the front desk and rented a room. The hotel clerk thought Blair looked very paranoid and agitated, and believed he was constantly looking around to make sure no one was following him. After checking in and getting a room key, Blair paid with a $100 bill, but left the hotel lobby without even waiting to get his change back. This took place at 7:37 p.m., and as far as anyone knows, Blair never actually went to his room, and this would turn out to be the last time he was seen alive until his body was discovered the following morning. There were a couple of reported sightings of Blair at a truck stop and at a Cracker Barrel restaurant in the hours after he left the hotel, and witnesses said he was in the company of another man, but authorities eventually ruled these sightings out, so I'm assuming the person these witnesses saw was not actually Blair. However, since meat, shrimp, and lettuce were found in Blair's stomach contents, he likely did go somewhere to have a meal before he was killed. The parking lot where Blair was found dead was about a half mile away from the Fairfield Inn, but no one knows what he would have been doing there. There was a truck stop located nearby which was known for being a hotbed for prostitution, but it failed to provide any leads related to Blair's death. But in a final bizarre twist, the key for the Toyota Camry, which Blair claimed he'd been unable to find, was lying on the ground near his body. The only potential lead was a report from a security guard at a nearby building who believed he heard a woman giving off a scream at around 3:30 a.m., which investigators believed was Blair's approximate time of death. When police contacted Blair's family and friends, None of them had any idea what he was doing in Knoxville, because as far as anyone knew, he had never been in the area before and didn't know anybody who lived there. Anyway, the case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries the following year, but it failed to generate any substantial leads, and the investigation pretty much ground to a dead halt. However, in September of 2017, writer Travis Dorman published an extensive article about the case in the Knoxville News Sentinel, which contained some previously undisclosed information, and incidentally, Dorman even published a post about this on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit I always frequent. Blair's mother, Sandra Edwards, was interviewed for the article and shared some surprising new details. Even though Blair had numerous girlfriends throughout the course of his life and was regarded as heterosexual, Sandra mentioned that he had once been romantically involved with a male roommate. But Sandra's most unexpected new reveal was that the reason for Blair's trip was to attend the 1996 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. While it's true that Blair's route would have eventually taken him to Atlanta, which was just over 200 miles away from Knoxville, the problem is that the Olympics did not actually start until July 19th, 8 days after Blair was found dead, and Sandra apparently never mentioned anything about Blair traveling to the Olympics when she was originally questioned by the authorities over 20 years ago. According to Travis Dorman, Sandra was initially open to talking about her son's death, but then abruptly hung up during one of their conversations and refused to speak with him again. When Dorman attempted to phone her back, Blair's stepfather answered the phone and angrily stated, "We are not going to open that can of worms again." According to the article, it seems that two of the investigators, Knox County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Unit Chief David Davenport and current Knox County Sheriff J.J. Jones, had differing theories about Blair's death. Davenport theorizes that Blair may have removed his pants while engaging in a sex act inside a vehicle, but then a struggle ensued, where Blair was beaten and thrown outside onto the pavement. The perpetrator then struck Blair with their vehicle before they fled the scene, and the vehicle's front bumper delivered the fatal blow which ruptured his stomach. However, Jones believes that it was a kick, not a vehicle, which delivered the fatal blow to Blair's stomach. Regardless, after 2 decades, there are still no answers about what actually caused the death of Blair Adams. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So yeah, you can see why this is such a heavily discussed unsolved mystery, because no matter how many different theories you dream up to explain what might have happened, none of them make complete sense. I think the biggest issue is that we really don't know what kind of mental state Blair was in at that time, so that's the first thing we should address. Even though there have been a lot of theories about Blair's odd behavior prior to his death, including that he may have been suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, it must be clarified that Blair was never officially diagnosed with any form of mental illness. While one of the original articles about the case did state that there was some history of mental illness in his family, this was never expanded upon. The consensus from most people who knew him is that even though Blair had struggled with demons in the past involving drugs and alcohol, he was a genuinely good-hearted person who liked to help people. It's easy to assume that a lot of Blair's actions may have been the result of falling off the wagon, but no traces of drugs or alcohol were found in his system, so it looks like he did manage to stay sober during the last 2 years of his life. If he was suffering from some sort of mental illness, then it probably didn't start affecting him until the weeks preceding his death, when his family and friends started noticing some disturbing changes in his behavior. Now, if I had to make a direct comparison between Blair's story and another unsolved case, the best example would be the 1997 death of Judy Smith, which I covered on one of the earliest episodes of this podcast. In case you're not familiar with this case, it's an equally baffling mystery about a woman who vanished without explanation during a business trip to Philadelphia, before her remains were discovered 600 miles away in a mountainous area in North Carolina. Even though the evidence suggested Judy had been murdered, no one knows how she wound up at this location to begin with. But the key difference between Judy's case and Blair's case is that she didn't exhibit any strange behavior before she went missing, and no paper trail could be found to determine how she made it to North Carolina. In Blair's case, investigators were able to track his exact movements from British Columbia to Knoxville. Honestly, if you were to chronologically follow the timeline of Blair's actions from beginning to end, it really fits the profile of a person who was suffering some sort of mental breakdown. If this was a missing persons case and Blair was never found, then most people would probably think this was a sad story of a victim who lost her grip on reality and wouldn't put much credence into Blair's claims that someone was trying to kill him. But in the end, Blair did wind up dead under bizarre, inexplicable circumstances, so you can't help but wonder if perhaps he was right all along. There's a famous expression, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't after you. So let's start from the beginning of Blair's cross-country odyssey and try to break this whole thing down step by step. Even though he had apparently been behaving strangely for weeks, the first warning sign that something might be seriously wrong is when Blair emptied his bank account and safety deposit box and then made a failed attempt to catch a ferry across the border on July 7th before he was turned away by the suspicious Border Patrol. Now, there are several confusing things about this. First off, since Blair emptied his account, the implication is that he was planning to make a run for it, but he did not actually show up at work to quit his job until July 8th, the day after he was turned away from the border. And then later that same afternoon is when he purchased the plane ticket to Germany. So did this mean that Blair was planning to return if he had managed to cross the border on July 7th? His decision to give notice at his job before he took off seems pretty strange, since it doesn't look like he attempted to settle any of his other affairs and never even told his family or friends that he was leaving. I guess it would make sense for Blair to quit if he wanted his final paycheck and to have additional money on him when he left, but it sounds like he didn't even bother to pick his check up. And then there's the route Blair took. Driving southwest from Surrey to Victoria takes 3 hours before you can even board the ferry to Seattle, but a straight drive south across the border from Surrey to Seattle only takes around 2.5 hours on its own. In fact, when Blair tried to cross the border by foot 2 days later, he took the more logical route by attempting to use the Pacific Highway border crossing into the town of Blaine. After that, all you have to do is keep driving south on Interstate 5 until you arrive in Seattle. We do know that when Blair eventually reached Seattle on July 9th, the only thing he did was go straight to the airport and hop on a flight out of town. So if Blair had made it to Seattle on July 7th, would he have still done the same thing? And let's not forget that there is an international airport in Vancouver, and Blair could have saved himself a lot of trouble if he just booked a flight from there. But since Blair seemed pretty paranoid and was convinced someone was trying to kill him, maybe he felt that taking a long-winded route to Victoria and then traveling to Seattle in order to fly to his destination was the only way to cover his tracks and avoid the people he believed were after him. Now, the fact that Blair originally booked a flight from Vancouver to Frankfurt, Germany, is one of the most intriguing parts of this story. Way back in 2005, a poster with the username NerdGirl showed up in a thread about the case at the Unsolved Mysteries message board in the Sitcoms Online forum. She claimed she was a friend of Blair's and made a couple of posts in which she discussed his past construction job in Frankfurt and his relationship with the German girl. Well, these details about Blair's time in Germany were never officially disclosed publicly until they were mentioned in the Knoxville News Sentinel article last year. You could assume that Blair booked the flight from Frankfurt with the intention of going to see his girlfriend, but she always maintained that she knew nothing about this and wasn't expecting him. Blair also expressed concern that some former co-workers from Germany were now in Canada and seeking retribution on him, but I don't know. I'm not sure if Blair's experience in Germany has any bearing on this case. I mean, Blair may have genuinely believed that these people were after him, but what could have possibly happened over there for someone to travel all the way from Germany to British Columbia and then follow him over 4,000 miles to Knoxville to kill him? The problem is that even though Blair's actions when he left his home don't make any sense from our perspective, they probably made sense from his perspective. Maybe his decision to book a flight to Germany was some sort of decoy tactic to throw some people off his trail, and he never had any intention of flying over there. After all, he did make a second attempt to cross the border on foot on the morning of July 9th, before he traveled to the Vancouver airport to turn in the ticket to Germany and rent a Nissan Altima. But if he had managed to successfully cross the border that morning, he would have been out over $1,000, since he never got the refund for the ticket. Of course, trying to enter Washington State at the Pacific Highway border crossing is a much more logical idea than traveling 3 hours from Surrey to Victoria to catch the ferry, but I'm pretty confused by the implication that he traveled to the border in a stolen blue car. One of Blair's friends thought they saw him driving a blue car the previous day, so I guess it's possible that Blair was so paranoid about being followed that he decided to steal a vehicle in order to drive to the border crossing undetected. But if that's the case, then how did Blair travel the 50 kilometers or so back to the Vancouver airport? Now, I want to mention another poster from the Unsolved Mysteries message board named Corrine1970, who also claimed she was a friend of Blair's and posted in one of the threads about his case several years ago. She shared two intriguing bits of info which have never been confirmed in any news articles about the case, but open up some interesting questions if they're true. Number one, Blair's Chevrolet Chevette was never found. I was able to find an article published in the Surrey Leader newspaper a few weeks after Blair's death, which stated that the authorities were looking for the Chevette, though I'm not sure if they ever did find it. If Blair did drive the Chevette to the airport, then he probably didn't park it in one of their lots, since it should have been easy to track down. So this would lend credence to the idea that Blair stole another car to drive to the border, but if so, what actually happened to the Chevette? I guess it's possible that Blair simply abandoned the vehicle at a location where it was eventually stolen by some random perp who had no connection to this case. The second interesting tidbit Corrine1970 shared was that the only reason Blair purchased a plane ticket to Washington, D.C. once he arrived at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport is because it was the first available flight. And that actually makes sense to me. No one could figure out Blair's logic in flying to D.C. and then renting a car to drive to Knoxville, but if Blair decided to literally hop on the first flight he could and did not care about the destination, then this would explain an awful lot. The decision seems to fit with Blair's paranoid behavior, since he decided to buy a one-way ticket rather than the much cheaper round-trip ticket, and he still had the key to the Nissan Altima in his possession when he arrived in Knoxville. This demonstrates to me that even though Blair had no further use for the Altima, he was so anxious to fly out of Seattle that he wouldn't even take the time to return his rental car. So we know Blair rented a Toyota Camry and started driving southwest before he ended up in Knoxville. The problem is that we don't really know what his final destination was supposed to be. I know that investigators thoroughly checked into any possible connections between Blair and Knoxville and found nothing, but I really don't think he ever intended to stop there. Remember, he only wound up being stranded because he misplaced the key to his Camry. The gas station where he supposedly lost his key was right off of Interstate 40, so it seems like Blair only stopped there to get fuel, but wound up staying in town once he discovered he would have to get his key replaced. But where was Blair ultimately planning to go? I can definitely believe that Blair only decided to buy a plane ticket to Washington because it was the first available flight. If he was intending to travel somewhere in the southern U.S., why not just take a direct flight there rather than fly to Washington and rent a car to drive hundreds of miles south? It's possible that Blair did not have a concrete plan and was just winging it in order to get as far away from British Columbia as possible. He was heading southwest in the direction of the U.S.-Mexico border, so maybe he was just taking a very long-winded route to flee the country. Now we're going to talk about the one aspect of this case which used to make my head explode, the disappearance and reappearance of the key to the Toyota Camry. The way the Unsolved Mysteries segment presented it, the Toyota key turned up missing after Blair stopped for gas in Knoxville, and he became very confused when he tried to use the key to his previous rental car, the Nissan Altima, to enter the Camry. The impression I got was that Blair and the Interstate Repair Service driver, Gerald Sapp, searched everywhere for the Toyota key and just could not find it before it magically reappeared beside Blair's body the following morning, which makes no sense whatsoever. However, when Sapp was interviewed in last year's Knoxville New Sentinel article, he clarified that he did ask Blair to check his pockets for the Toyota key, but Blair actually refused to do so. This indicates to me that Blair had the Toyota key in his pocket the entire time, but for whatever reason, he would not look for it and got himself stranded in Knoxville for no reason. During his interview, Sapp described Blair as not being all there and believed his mind was not functioning correctly. Even though he had no involvement in Blair's death, Sapp was questioned extensively by police, who even took hair samples from him, and you can kind of understand why. Since Blair's behavior just seemed to defy all logic, you'd almost have to wonder if Sapp was telling the truth about his encounter with him. But I'm sure he was, and Blair's ultra-paranoid behavior in the lobby of the Fairfield Inn adds credence to the idea that there was something seriously wrong with his mental state at that point. So after paying for his room, Blair never actually went inside and just exited the hotel lobby, and the next thing we know is that he was found dead the next morning. In spite of his strange behavior, I personally don't think it's that unusual that Blair didn't go straight inside his hotel room. It was 7:37 p.m. at that point, and since recently eaten food was discovered inside Blair's stomach contents, it's possible he went out for dinner somewhere. But even so, there's nearly 12 hours in which his whereabouts are unaccounted for. It's very odd because there's a massive paper trail to pinpoint Blair's exact movements during his 4,000-mile trip from British Columbia to Knoxville, but nothing to indicate what he was doing between the time he left the hotel lobby to when he was found dead. We have the report from the security guard who believed he heard a woman scream at 3:30 a.m., and since investigators seem to believe 3:30 was Blair's approximate time of death, that scream is probably connected to it. But even so, that's still an 8-hour window of time when we don't know where Blair was. It sounds like there were eyewitness reports of Blair with an unidentified man at various locations that night, but police have discounted them. I still believe that Blair only wound up stranded in Knoxville by pure chance and had no personal connection to the city, so I have no idea what he could have been doing during this time period. Whatever it was, the end result turned out to be one of the weirdest, most inexplicable death scenes I've ever come across. It's pretty clear-cut that Blair wasn't in his right mind, and if he had been found dead in a body of water or a wooded area, then I'd be willing to believe his death may have been suicide, accidental, or succumbing to exposure. But I just don't see how a person could die from a ruptured stomach unless someone else was involved. If the circumstances were extreme enough, I guess it's possible Blair could have ruptured his own stomach, but he would have had to use an object of some sort, and nothing like that was found near his body. So an unknown third party had to have delivered the fatal blow which killed Blair, and there are two possibilities. Number one, Blair's paranoia was correct, and someone really was trying to kill him. Or number two, Blair crossed paths with a random stranger, and wound up getting into an altercation which ended with them receiving a fatal injury. Quite frankly, option number two just seems a lot more plausible to me. I have my doubts that Blair's death was premeditated murder, as delivering a fatal blow to one's stomach is such an odd way to kill someone. The reason I prefer option number two is because when you look at Blair's paranoid behavior, I could see him going up to a stranger whom he had no connection with and starting trouble. After all, some of Blair's co-workers in Germany said he had a tendency to be confrontational and start fights. For all we know, this person could have only been acting in self-defense and hightailed it out of the area without even knowing Blair's injury was fatal. But once they learned about Blair's death in the media, and saw there was going to be a police investigation, there was no way they were coming forward to admit what they did. And I think we can rule out the idea of Blair being attacked by a random criminal who wanted to rob him, given that they left behind thousands of dollars in cash and other assorted valuables. I just think Blair being killed by a local resident with no connection to him makes a lot more sense than someone following him thousands of miles from British Columbia to Knoxville in order to kill him. Really, think about how this series of events would go. This person is able to follow Blair from Surrey to the US-Canada border, then back to Vancouver International Airport, then to Victoria, onto a ferry, which crosses the border and travels to Seattle, and then they follow Blair to the airport and somehow manage to board Blair's flight to Washington, D.C., and then follow him as he drives hundreds of more miles until he stops in Knoxville, and that's when they decide to kill him. I just don't see how it's physically possible for someone to successfully keep up with Blair for that long without losing track of him. This is the type of scenario you'd expect to find in a spy story, not something involving a construction foreman from British Columbia. If there was something in Blair's background which was so out of the ordinary that it would compel someone to follow him across an entire continent for thousands of miles over two straight days, investigators never found it. Which is why I'm almost 100% convinced that Blair's paranoia about someone trying to kill him was all in his head. But the key word here is almost, but I'll get back to that in a second. While I do think it's plausible for Blair to have been killed because he got into a confrontation with the wrong person, that doesn't account for why his pants and socks were removed and turned inside out. If someone delivered a fatal blow to Blair's stomach in the heat of the moment in order to defend themselves, there really is no reason to remove his clothing. Like I mentioned earlier, one investigator developed his own theory that Blair removed his clothing for a sexual encounter which went horribly wrong and ended with him being killed. Perhaps the sexual encounter took place inside a vehicle, and the perpetrator struck Blair with their bumper and ruptured his stomach. It's interesting how police have stated there was evidence that Blair was sexually assaulted, but no DNA was left behind. They've never expanded upon this, but if you watch the Unsolved Mysteries segment, they show a photo of Blair's autopsy report, and if you look close enough, you can make out the words anal penetration. So this seems to indicate to me that Blair was penetrated by something, but there was no semen found. I think this would be a good time to address some of the odd comments from Blair's mother, Sandra Edwards, in the Knoxville News Sentinel article last year. For starters, I really do not believe her new claim that Blair was traveling down south to see the Olympic Games in Atlanta, since they were not due to start for over a week, and if this was true, I don't see why she never told this to the authorities 20 years ago. And then there's the fact that Sandra suddenly mentioned out of the blue that even though Blair was heterosexual, he had a male roommate whom he became romantically involved with at one point. It's interesting how one of the investigators interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries specifically stated that Blair was not a homosexual. It's clear to me that right from the outset, the police were looking into the possibility that Blair was killed because of a sexual encounter with another man. Just because Blair had a number of girlfriends does not mean he wasn't bisexual or interested in other men. Since the location Blair was found was in close proximity to a truck stop which was known for having prostitution, maybe Blair went searching for sex during his time away from the hotel. If he was caught in the middle of a sex act with another man, perhaps his death was a hate crime. But then, we also have the account from the security guard who heard a woman scream at 3:30 a.m., and if it was connected to Blair's death, then this means that at the very least, a woman was present when Blair was killed. Perhaps he was engaged in a sex act with a woman, but another man, perhaps a jealous boyfriend or husband, discovered them and attacked Blair. Remember, the only piece of physical evidence at the scene which pointed to an outsider was a long strand of hair in Blair's hand, which may have belonged to a woman, but since there's never been a DNA match, the hair's owner has probably not been convicted of a crime. Whatever the case, whoever attacked Blair had no interest in taking his money or valuables he had on him, which is why a sex act gone bad is a plausible motive. But here's one more final theory I want to address. There's a very lengthy and detailed post on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit written by a poster named A Lazy Fox Mulder, which gives quite an interesting explanation to account for some of the bizarre evidence at the scene. The implication seems to be that Blair was the victim of anal penetration, and as unpleasant as this may sound, the theory put forth here is that Blair may have been smuggling something in that orifice, and whoever killed him removed the item before they fled the scene. Yeah, I know this sounds a bit over the top and pretty gruesome, and I'm not sure I entirely believe that's what actually happened, but it does kind of explain some of the stranger details. Investigators believed Blair's pants were forcibly removed in a pulling motion because they were found inside out, which would support the idea of a sexual assault, but another odd thing is that his socks were also removed and turned inside out. When you take into account that Blair's money and the key to his Toyota Camry were scattered all over the pavement, It does seem like someone might have been checking for something inside his clothing, which included his socks. They clearly had no interest in Blair's money or his other valuables, but they could have been interested in another item he was carrying. And well, bear with me here, but if Blair was smuggling an item inside his rectum and they managed to retrieve it, then this could have done enough damage to resemble a sexual assault. I don't know, this is a pretty intriguing theory, but like I mentioned earlier, it just sounds like something you would find in a spy novel. Given that Blair had a past criminal record for drugs, a more down-to-earth explanation is that Blair was involved in drug trafficking, as people involved in that racket will sometimes conceal drugs inside their body cavity while attempting to smuggle them. Maybe the reason Blair looks so visibly nervous during his attempt to cross the border is because, well, he had drugs up his rectum. But investigators never did find anything in Blair's background to suggest he was involved in drug trafficking. And even if he was, and people really were trying to kill him, I just don't see how they would have been able to track him to Knoxville on that particular night. So what really did happen to Blair Adams? Well, I can't really come up with a concrete explanation which makes complete sense. If you asked Unsolved Mysteries fans which cases from the show they consider to be the most baffling, Blair Adams and Aileen Conway are two of the most frequent answers. Like I said earlier, if you believe Blair simply suffered a mental breakdown, then this is a mystery which actually makes about 80% complete sense, but the circumstances of his death just throw everything for a loop. However, unlike some other bizarre unexplained deaths, you just cannot write this one off as a suicide or accident, because even if it was an intentional, premeditated murder, there has to be someone else involved who knows exactly what happened to Blair. If I had to guess, I'd say that none of Blair's fears about his life being in danger had any basis in reality, and that he had no idea what he was doing when he made his cross-country odyssey. It might just be a coincidence that he really did wind up dead at the end of his journey, only it was by complete chance and involved someone else who had no idea who Blair even was before that night. I really don't have much idea about what exactly happened, but I have a hunch that whoever was responsible for Blair's death didn't plan on killing him. But because they ended the life of a man who had traveled there from the other side of the continent and did a number of inexplicable things, then the investigation into his death wound up becoming a lot more complicated than they ever could have imagined. If I had to put together a list of unsolved mysteries I most want to see solved, then this one would be near the very top, because it is such a head-scratcher. But I have a hunch that it isn't anything larger than life, and that the ultimate explanation will probably be a lot simpler than the evidence makes it out to be. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved death of Blair Adams, please contact the Knoxville County Sheriff's Office at 865-215-2675. That's 865-215-2675. Anyway, another special thanks to Christy Tarver for doing such a great job at narrating our opening. This has become a popular recurring monthly contest for our listeners, and if you've already entered the contest before, you are automatically eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you want to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Anyway, once again, the Trail Went Cold has just been launched on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Just last week, we released our very first exclusive bonus episode for our donors in tiers 2 and 3, and the episode chronicles the amazing life of the one and only Robert Stack. For everyone in tier 3, you will get exclusive access to Vince Nitro's music tracks from The Trail Went Cold, which have been in demand for a long time. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our most recent patrons who have signed up to support us on Patreon, and they are the Dark Poutine Podcast, the Fallline Podcast, Hank, Kirby R, Kepi B, Ashley B, Jenny S, Raquel B, M, Carol, Diana G, Paul R, and the one and only Christy T. And this would also be a good time to thank our recurring monthly donors on PayPal, and they are Aura, Lewis, Kathleen, Brian, Laura, Ellie, Purity, Dawn, Claire, and Elliot. Thank you so much to everyone for your generosity. And since CrimeCon has come and gone, it is now time for The Trail Went Cold to prepare for the next major podcasting convention we'll be appearing at, Potter and Love, which will be taking place at the Intercontinental Hotel in New Orleans on August 10th to the 12th. Here's a promo with more information.
Hi, I'm Dina Marie, the host of the Twisted Philly podcast, and I've got a question for you. Do you love podcasts? Because I sure do. And that's why the podcast community, Podcast We Listen To, is hosting their very first podcast convention for listeners. It's called Potter and Love. The Potter and Love convention is for listeners by listeners. It's for all of us. And it includes podcasts from every genre you could imagine, including comedy, movies and TV, pop culture, paranormal, history, health and fitness, true crime, and so many more. Our first convention is August 10th, 11th, and 12th, 2018, in one of the coolest cities in the country, New Orleans, Louisiana. And it's being held at the Intercontinental Hotel, which is a premier French Quarter hotel. The location is amazing. And the room rate can't be beat either. It's only $129 a night. Tickets are on sale on the website at www.podern.love. That's www.podern.love. There are over 40 independent podcasts already lined up to present at Potter and Love, and we'll be adding more before the convention. Plus, featured podcasters have discount codes, so you can get a discount on your tickets. Be sure to follow Potter and Love on Twitter and Facebook for the latest convention updates, news, information about new shows that are joining, and links to a dedicated website just for Potter and Love attendees to book their hotel room. We can't wait to see you this August in New Orleans.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the aforementioned Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. You can find interesting threads about this case at both those sites. I need to provide my thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes our eerie music score, which you can now access if you are one of our Tier 3 donors on Patreon. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And we also have a Facebook discussion group if you would like to discuss these cases or true crime in general with myself and your fellow listeners. So have yourself a good week and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶